Colonel Pride, Carreel 3.
This defiling, as I said, was the most unusual thing to British troops, and it usually consisted of the genitals being cut off and stuffed in the mouth. This seemed to be their major way of defiling the body. I never saw it personally, but I heard many stories of the slow death given to some of those who were captured alive. And usually it was a question of stabbing them and stabbing them until finally they died pretty nastily. There were cases also that I heard of, but again, as I say, I don't know from first-hand experience, where they'd been taken back to villages, particularly officers, and then it was left the women to finish them off. This apparently was the worst thing they could do to a man, and it was a pretty nasty slow death. I think one will find this recorded in history and other records and things, particularly from earlier periods, but it seemed to have lasted on into the campaign I was on, and I'd heard this as true stories from political officers, so I think it was true that they did this sort of thing. If it wasn't true, nevertheless, we believed it, and we did see the defiling ourselves, and it was ugly to see. As far as the men were concerned, there was a natural wish to get their own back somehow. To my knowledge, the British troops never did defile bodies back again. It's foreign to a Britisher to do such a thing. There's no point in it. But with the Gurkha troops, certainly they retaliated, and they did the same thing with Pathan bodies that they got, unless they were stopped by British officers in time. I'm not saying the British troop didn't do it because there wasn't a wish to get his own back in the Bataan. He did very much indeed, but somehow this defiling of bodies didn't mean anything to him. And so if he had to kill a Bataan, he killed a Bataan, and he was glad to bring the body in, because this was a sort of a point of honour with both sides, that you always recovered your own dead bodies. It may have started with the Bataans because they didn't like the body to be defiled, and therefore they made certain they brought it in. But certainly they would fight like mad to make certain they got their dead bodies in. And we did the same because we knew otherwise they would be defiled like this. And then afterwards they would tell the political officer where the body was to be found. This sort of thing didn't, of course, make the political officer any more popular.
Were the Pathans as good shots as they were always made out to be?
Difficult one. Most of their rifles were homemade. They had their own factories up there, pretty primitive, and therefore they weren't very accurate. But as each round cost them a lot of money to make, and each rifle cost them a lot of money to make, they would spend hours over every shot to make certain it was effective. And so, although it may be a very inaccurate rifle, they learned it shot sideways a foot from the sights or whatever it was, and they would learn from their mistakes. And then they would have the most infinite patience lining up their rifle in a rock on a target, you maybe. If you moved about, it was more difficult for him, but if you stood static for a length of time, he would eventually get his thing lined up, and finally pull the trigger, and that one shot would probably go home. Very rarely did you get fusillades of shots. It did happen occasionally, but mostly it was the odd few shots where a number of men had lined up, waiting in an ambush of some sort. They fired their shots fairly accurately, and then they got away. And this is a form of guerrilla warfare. So, answer to your question is, they were good shots in that they had the patience and they knew their weapon. The weapons were bad, and so with bad weapons, they did very well.
I think you said that they actually tried to make some big gun.
Yes, there was one gun that they made, and this was used against us in the light column we had in late 38, I think it was. And they fired this gun once or twice into us, and then after that they got it away because they discovered, in fact, it didn't suit their guerrilla tactics, because we'd always, by day, have some aircraft, however primitive our aircraft were in those days, to trace the gun. It was a very difficult thing to handle. It wasn't success. It wasn't their way of fighting. I'd like to get back to rifles that I made, that their young men, their young boys carried rifles from a very young age. I don't know what age it was, but certainly the first thing that any young young boy did was to fire a rifle as soon as he could, and then the greatest honour could happen was when his father gave him a rifle. And you found these youngsters, we'd call them teenagers, I suppose, going down the valleys, usually beautifully dressed and turned out with silk shirts or rose behind the ear, and they'd pass your column and they'd give a great big wave, and straight away they'd go, as I said earlier on, they'd dash up to the nearest hill and they'd take a shot at you. So from a young age they were accustomed to shooting. Not only you, this fighting went on in feuds between them. They're rather like the, well, perhaps the Sicilians or someone like that. They had their feuds amongst themselves, between families, between villages, and this feud might go on until one family was completely eliminated.
What was morale like on the frontier?
I would say very high. This goes, I think, in my experience over a number of years in the army, goes with when you have an object and you have a bit of danger. And not only do we have some danger and an object, but we also were very physically fit. I think it was the fittest time I've ever been, fittest I've ever been in all my life was on that time on the frontier. You went up hills very fast indeed, and you always came down at the double, flat out. And you climb 1,000 feet, 2,000 feet, maybe up to 4,000 feet, flat out, and then run all the way down. You're going to be very, very fit. And so the morale was very, very high. I believe the regiment before us, I mentioned, that came back early, the Argylls and Sutherlands, I believe their morale suffered because they had some reverses. We had trained seriously. I think we had a very fine commanding officer with us commanding at the time. And so we, I mean, this is luck, as a result of what happened, we managed to do well right from the word go, and so our morale was high after a very short time. You're naturally frightened when you first go. Are you going to be able to, your first action, are you going to do well? Are you good enough? And going into a Gurkha brigade, where these Gurkha regiments had spent time on the frontier, time off, time back again, you wondered how you were going to compete. And we found after only a few weeks we could be just as good, and in fact we could be better. Once they discovered that, then the morale went up straight away. There was this complex originally, the Gurkhas are good, you know, they're always going to be better than us, we can't be as good as them. Then we found things like timing us down. There was always competition who could run down the fastest from these pickets, because this was the efficiency, was to get down fast before the battalion could come round the flank of the hill and get you. We found that we could beat the Gurkha timings. This was very encouraging to find that physically our chaps could beat the Gurkhas in the hills.
Was it not a problem with your unit trying to cope with the monastic conditions away from the female sex on the frontier?
I would say it was less on the frontier than it was on the plains. You segregated everything into being masculine on the northwest frontier. No woman was allowed up there. Lots of women tried to sneak up there, disguise, all sorts of things. You didn't see women because they were hidden away in the villages. Maybe particular officers saw them, but certainly you were soldiers, never even saw Pathan women. And it got so ridiculous, it's probably a bit of a joke actually, but I mean, even bitches weren't allowed up there. You could take your dogs or your regiment up there, but no bitches. There may have been sense behind it, otherwise I suppose they would have proliferated up there and become a nuisance in a base area like Rusmuk, which is a pretty small knit community, or if you're operating out in operations like the Champlain was earlier on. But you were so physically fit up there and so occupied, and there were no temptations, no women to let you think of women, that I don't think it was such a problem. Of course it was a problem, yes, but it was nothing like the problem that it was on the plains. Certainly I don't know of homosexuality, certainly in my regiment. I didn't hear of it in any other regiments. So There obviously must have been a big problem, but not anything like it was in the plants. Probably because you had an object, you were in operations, and you were fully occupied and kept absolutely flat out the whole time.
Who were these women who tried to sneak into the country?
Oh, there were various stories about... it's such a challenge to women, I think, to find some place in the world where they aren't allowed, that various wives had tried to smuggle themselves up there. Some silly young girl out with a fishing fleet had tried it too, dressed up as a man. There were all sorts of stories went around about how they had tried to get up there to be the only woman. Some of them may have succeeded, I don't know. I mean, I believe that once one woman got as far as Rasmuk before she was discovered and then sent back again, in which case she must have done very well.
Were there any restrictions on the officers marrying in India?
I wouldn't say it's particularly... there's two angles to this. One is, first of all, the question of officers marrying. It's an interesting point. You've got no marriage allowances as an officer until you were age 28, which by modern standards, of course, is very high. Secondly, in my own regiment, we were told you couldn't marry without the colonel of the regiment's promotion until you were 30. So straight away, as a young officer, you knew you couldn't marry, or you couldn't marry and stay in the regiment anyway until you were 30, unless there were exceptional conditions, such as you met perhaps a very rich young girl or something. There was sense behind this insofar as you did become a dedicated young bachelor. There was nothing else you could do. All your money, such as you got, was spent doing regimental work, taking part in community life. And therefore, you weren't diverted from the main purpose of your life. As for the question of marrying anybody in India, this was a problem because if you were turned 30 and you were thinking of marrying, well, there was nobody there. The only women there, after all, if you try to categorize them, were other officers' wives. The girls sent out on a trip from England, who were known as a fishing fleet, because they'd probably had their coming out in England, hadn't married, and some relations had probably said, oh, well, send you out to India and see what life is like out there. They had a lovely time, and they were all spoilt after about the first 6 months, because they were asked out by all the subalterns so much. And they were serious, so I mean, if you dated them too much, you were bound to find yourself married to one. And then there were the Indian women, but then you didn't meet Indian women as such. In your social life, your British club was British. So you didn't meet Indian women of the kind that you would marry. The same went for quite a large community, which is still there in India, which is the Anglo-Indian, based on the canals and the railway organizations, very highly efficient organizations, which were mostly based on British, probably ex-army people, probably some sergeant who's been out there for years and due to leave the army, he retired there with an Indian wife, and these are the descendants. And they had their own clubs. They didn't want to mix with the Indians. They weren't accepted by the British, so they formed their own local society and community. And here, again, it was a form of racialism, I suppose. It was not done for you to be seen in public with them. And this is not done certainly in British regiments, and I don't think in Indian Army regiments either. So really, there was no choice. You didn't have the opportunity in India to marry until you came back to England.
Was VD a problem, particularly in India?
Yes, it was a big problem. I don't have any problem as far as the officers are concerned. And if one tries to analyse that, I'm not quite certain why, except that there was such a strong code and a moral stigma about VD that as an officer, you knew the penalty was out. If you were discovered with VD, you would have been out the regiment like a shot and back to England. So it was the end of your life in the regiment and therefore probably in the army. A soldier Again, there was an imposed stigma by the army, but amongst themselves, of course, they, if they could get away with it, would do so. And so there was a lot of question of trying to hide it. The army imposed the most stringent penalties on it. I think unless you had proper organized registered brothels, there seemed to be very little answer to it except the way the army handled it. There had been brothels before, organized regimentally or on station, but a previous viceroy's wife, and I think it was Lady Willingdon, had discovered that these existed and had got the viceroy to forbid them. They were all closed down, certainly before I reached India. They did keep down the rate of VD because they were inspected by medical officers and properly organized, and therefore there was less VD. Once those were removed, the soldier had nothing else to turn to except the Indian women. Now, the only Indian women he would meet, would mix with him, would be the very low-caste Indian woman who was a prostitute. And they, being prostitutes with their in large cities like Delhi, Meerut, Ferozepur, etc., were all riddled with VT. There were not enough doctors to cure them. And so any soldier going out and having intercourse of any sort was almost bound to get VD. We did the best we could in a crude army way and with our knowledge we had then, and that was that the soldier could go to what was called an ET room, an early treatment room, and collect a condom, as we called the French letter in those days, before, on his way out, was encouraged to, in fact, and on his way back, he could clock through the ET room, cleanse himself, and all the antiseptics and washing arrangements were there, and sign a book. If he did that and got VD, this meant that he was eased of a lot of the penalties that would otherwise happen. If he didn't do this and got VD, then he got the full rigor of the law, and that was being head up, and then punished with all sorts of penalties, up to 28 days detention, or there were private penalties by regiments, whereby the chap for many weeks afterwards had to do afternoon parades on a hot afternoon, doubling round the square with a heavy pack on his back, and so on. These punitive things never really could stamp it out. The crime, as far as the soldier was concerned, was in getting caught out.
Did you not say that one regiment was sent to Multan as punishment for its incidents of VD?
Yes, Multan was a punishment station. I've only passed through Multan. My brother had experience of it, and I gather from him it was a stinking hot place, one of the hottest places in India. And a certain regiment in India, the VD got to such a rate that it really immobilised them if they had to go into operations. And this happened to, I think it's historical, so I'm not giving away any, I'm not slanging another regiment. It was so, it was the Duke of Wellington's regiment, in fact. My brother did his attachment to it at that time. And they were sent there as a punishment. I don't know what their previous station had been, but they had contracted VD above a certain percentage. It was the highest percentage in India amongst the British regiments, and therefore they were sent there as a punishment.
How important was sport to you in India?
Extremely important. It was very difficult. You asked me earlier on about our morale. The object of being in India wasn't apparent to you when there was no trouble, or you weren't on the frontier. And so sport was terribly important to keep people... to replace morale with a purpose in life. And so you encouraged your men all the sport you could and the officers, and so every spare moment of your life was in fact sport. It kept you physically fit, which was part of being a soldier in those days. After all, soldiering was not so technical as nowadays. The soldier had a rifle, he had a bayonet, you had some Lewis guns as supporting weapons, and so mostly your fighting was men going in with a rifle after long marches. You didn't have trucks in those days. So fitness was part of your job professionally. So soldier spent all his time being physically fit on games and things, and ditto were the officers. Plus added on encouragement always to be good on horseback. this idea was the same throughout the whole of the British Army, any part of the world, was that infantry should go across country and not stick to roads. And the only way in which you could get a good, true appreciation of the country, of hills and valleys and the value of how to attack a place and appreciating the ground you were going over, was to be as mobile as possible across country yourself. And that, of course, the only way in those days was on a horse.
Were horse sports most important to you personally, of all the sports?
Yes, I think they were very important. Now, obviously, your first thing was to be an efficient soldier, because whether you wanted or not, you were going to be made to be one anyway, so you might as well enjoy it. And so you played the sports, and you enjoyed it with your men. And in India, you played football, you played hockey, you played all the games that everybody plays, cricket. You played the whole lot with your men. Hockey was particularly keen in India, because it's a great game in India. You've got hard grounds and the fast balls, it makes for a very fast, exciting game. And then in addition, if you were lucky enough and you were interested enough, you would get a lot of riding. And there were these unique sports that you could not either afford or you didn't have in England. Polo was a game that obviously most of us couldn't really afford in England at all, unless you were in some cavalry regiment. But you could afford in India, and so why not enjoy it? The station I first went to, which was Meerut, that was the home of pig-sticking. There was a unique sport of the whole world, almost. So why not indulge in that and enjoy that? It was a very thrilling one. After the frontier, I was at Lahore, and we did have our own foxhounds there. We brought out from India, 14 couple, and founded our own greenhounds hunt. There again, you could hunt very, very cheaply indeed, for almost nothing. So why not hunt and enjoy that? And there was point to point, again, a comparatively expensive sport in England, which we did very cheaply. So we enjoyed it very much indeed. Yes.
How dangerous was pig sticking?
You couldn't get insurance for it, so I don't think it worried us at that time. I do remember taking out an insurance on my life at that time. I don't know who sold it to me, who advised me, but.
Because
I did. No, it wasn't. It was. I don't know what caused it. It's way back in memory. I can't remember what I actually got out for, but I do remember that it did not include pig sticking.
Didn't you tell me that you were hauled up before the commanding officer on one occasion because of your resignation from a club because you wanted to save money for your sporting activities?
This was after we came back to the frontier. We were in Ferozepur at the time. There was a lot of sporting activity there, and as far as it was, we had our own foxhounds, I said. We had this point to point, we had polo, we had the lot, and it was awfully nice to have several horses. And there was a very nice local club there, a cantonment club, but two or three of us were working out really on Saturday nights. What did you do on Saturday nights at the club? You went along, you had a very nice evening certainly, but you weren't serious about dancing. You didn't want to play tennis particularly. You had these other much more important things like horses to think of. So we thought we would save money by resigning from the club and spending it on getting another horse instead each. But possibly rightly, the commanding officer had us up and said, you can't do that sort of thing. Your job is to partake in community life, learn to be members of a team here, because you'll have to fight as a team, and you must live as a team. And therefore, and if everybody did this, there'd be no club anyway. And what would life be like if you had no centre of activities in the local community? So I won't say he exactly ordered us to. He gave a very strong wish to us that, with reasoning why we should remain members of the club, and we saw the strength of his reasoning and the fact he was commanding, so we did what we heard.
Did you ever hunt tiger?
I went after tiger on one particular show, yes. It was tiger country. It wasn't in Bengal where the tiger country is. I think it was in the CP. But Central Provinces. But I remember being there for about a week after Tiger, and we sat up, certainly on two nights, on a platform you build on a tree, and you have a young goat tied up somewhere beneath you, which bleats all night, and that is the bait for the tiger. And you wait there, and you for movement, and then when you hear movement, you shine the torch and you shoot. It's a very nice experience, a very exciting one, but no tiger came near us. The shikari who look after you and organize the whole thing, they're supposed to take you only to where the tiger are. There's no doubt from the general sort of sharp, acrid smells you've got around there that there had been tiger around, but they certainly didn't fall for it when I was there.
Did you ever make any Indian friends whilst you were in India?
I think that question is absolutely no. This is probably one of the great faults we had in India, and this was so. I think the Indian civil service administrators and the political service certainly had Indian friends, but as a young British army officer, you didn't have the opportunity of meeting them at all. This was probably something, a fault in the whole system there, and I don't think that would happen under any conditions nowadays, but certainly the answer to your question is no. It was interesting that I left India in very early 1940. When I got back to England, I did get a cutting sent to me because it was of the picture of the wedding of somebody of my name, Prague, being married in Lahore Cathedral, which is near where I'd been, and he was marrying an Indian princess. But that's the only time I've come across true mixing, a chap actually marrying an Indian. And normally you didn't meet them at all. You met the Anglo-Indians quite frequently, but not the Indians. Unless they were the contractors, the people working for you, but you didn't make friends with them.